Accession number 27767, Reel 12.
And what had happened was this, that the Allied armies had advanced so far into the continent that they had liberated Radio Luxembourg, which used to be a famous commercial station before the war. No commercial stations were allowed in Britain until about the 50s. And this, by some quirk of the airwaves, had very annoyingly intruded on our frequency.
So when you were being an aircraft and you were being directed, what sort of commands were they using?
Well, the commands would be, there was a whole system of RT, radio telephone procedure. This was taught by a Lieutenant Bunny Collins, whom I came to know very well after the war. And for instance, you would have, if you were told to go buster, that meant that you had to the aircraft was to go at its fullest speed. Liner was that you went at a normal speed, and so on. And then, if you wanted to tell them the course they should go on, you would say vector starboard 240, and they would steer 240. Until you gave them another vector, as it was called. So vector was the way in which you should they should fly the aircraft. Tally-ho was used for by the fighter pilots when they saw the enemy, and you would talk of Angels 5, meaning they were to go to a height of 5,000 feet, and so on. There was a whole language to learn, and we had to learn these in the... what was perhaps an amusing thing was that Bunny Collins would go up to London every about 2 months and choose the wrens who had volunteered to become the radar plot wrens. And Collins had an eye for a good-looking girl, and it was no coincidence that the wrens at Spickington Manor were, besides being some of the brightest, also the prettiest girls in the service, which was saying something.
Right. Adrian Holloway, end of reel 11. Adrian Holloway, reel 12.
The rest of the instruction at Spickington Manor was done in large simulators, which were designed to be either the aircraft direction room of a large carrier, a small carrier, or that of a cruiser. And we would go in there and direct aircraft. There was a large Perspex screen in front of us, behind which the wrens stood, and they had to write on that in reverse writing so that it appeared correct to us. But they had to write it in reverse because they were the other side of the screen. So they had to learn to do that. Crosses would appear where enemy aircraft were appearing. And it was beautifully designed, so you could see the whole picture exactly of what was happening. And the wrens would be in what was called the cookhouse, where, under the direction of the instructors, they would put all the commands into you and into the enemy, and you had to deal with the situation. Once we reenacted the Battle of Midway, which was the only battle in the Pacific where neither side saw each other, the whole thing was conducted in the air, and it was a complete defeat for the Japanese. And I remember I was the Japanese Admiral Nagumo. I can't remember whether I won or lost, but...
it sounds quite sort of exciting and quite fun.
I loved it. Training. I loved it. It was absolutely super, and it really was. The only thing was that you couldn't... there was not much relaxation, really. You had to get a taxi if you wanted a car. Nobody got a car. Yeovil wasn't exactly a sort of haunt of vice. It was No, it really was great fun, and you lived with the instructors. They knew you. You knew them. The instructors had taken over the Bruton School, Hazelgrove House, and they lived there. And then we were moved after Charlton Hawthorne to the Sparkford Inn, which was delightful again because the bar part of the Sparkford Inn was being used by the general public. And so in the evening we would change into civilian clothes and join them in the Skittle Alley, join the ordinary patrons in the Skittle Alley. So that was good fun. The makeup of fighter direction officers at that time was interesting. It was 98% RNVR, and I was one of the first RN officers to qualify. And they were usually of three groups. They were either schoolmasters, barristers, or actors. And Kenneth Moore was in the course one ahead of me. And when I qualified, my appointments at the Admiralty were done by none other than Lieutenant Commander, later Sir Michael Horden. So you had to have a quick brain, and I suppose that's what, say as I do, we all possessed, because you had to take decisions instantly and be able to countermand what you'd done instantly too, because the situation was so fluid up in the air. As you could see, the enemy quickly either avoiding or coming in, you had to get yourselves ready to take them on.
Did you do any training with aircraft up in the air, as opposed to?
No, I wish we had. I think the thing was this, that Yeovilton itself was being run very naturally as a fighter training place. There weren't many fighters there that had two cockpits. And so although we would very much like to have done, and I just at the end of the war and after the war did fly with the Fleet Arm, I never flew with them as a fighter director, which we should have done, but I think it was just in circumstances it was impossible.
So how long did this training take altogether?
It took 6 months. And every now and then we would have a test and hope that we'd pass that. Then at the end of March, we had a sort of passing out exam. And as I said, I managed to fool the examiners and become out top.
So the war, obviously, that things have progressed hugely, you know, after Normandy landings and so on. Were you expecting the war to finish soon, or did you think you were going to be able to use all this training?
Well, it must not be forgotten that the Pacific War had by no means ended. And that's really where we were directing our minds to. We knew, of course, that the European War was near its end. But then, you see, in September 1944, you had the failure of Operation Market Garden, which was Arnhem. And so things stagnated, except for the Battle of the Bulge. And also, it was a very, very cold winter. And on the continent, I don't think things could move much. As I say, really, we knew that Japan was our main target.
Yeah. So big celebrations at the end of the course, I expect.
Well, yes, there were. I think we all went out for a drink and so on. But as I say, there was nothing much we could do. At the end of the course, we were all sent up to an aircraft carrier in the Clyde to watch landings on and landings off and taking off. And during that time, one aircraft crashed into the island, which is at the side of the carrier. And, I think the pilot was killed, which was all rather frightful. And it was whilst we were up in the Clyde for that week that we heard that Roosevelt had died. Well, after that, I think because I had become top, I was sent on what's called a dagger course. Now, a dagger course for which you had, by your name in the Navy list, a little dagger, meant that you'd done a special course, whether it was gunnery or signals or whatever. And they sent me up to a big RAF radar station at Acklington in Northumberland.
Acklington.
And I was there when VE Day came. So, once again, we weren't able to do any celebrations since we was completely cut off. No transport again. But I enjoyed my time there. And, of course, this was to be taught night fighter direction, which was in its infancy with the Navy. And to be quite honest, I don't think that it was ever used very much. And what is more, we had far greater facilities with huge radar aerials than anything that could be put into a ship. With a ship, you're limited in the size of the aerial you can put in, because you put one in too big and the ship capsizes. You can't have too much on the mast. So that is a bit of a daunting thing. And all the equipment that the RAF had was vastly superior to anything you'd have found a ship. So I suppose I spent about a fortnight there, I think. And then I went home on leave. And I had about 4 weeks leave. And then I was ordered to proceed to Liverpool, where I joined the Stirling Castle, a Union Castle liner before the war, now being used as a troop ship. And that was rather a peculiar voyage in a way, because we went out to Australia via the Atlantic, the Caribbean, and the Panama Canal. And it was rather a mixture on board, because by that time, of course, the war had ended in Europe. And so there were quite a few naval personnel like me and others. But the majority were Australian personnel, and most of them ex-prisoners of war. Now, they were a very stroppy crowd. They'd been used to being ordered about and bullied around for perhaps 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And they weren't going to take orders from anybody. What is more, they'd all had their back pay for all that considerable time, and so they were playing solo and bridge and poker and everything else for stakes that we could never hope to do. Fortunately, they couldn't drink because it was dry, but in there I had an advantage over them because I had an introduction to the captain. One of my godfathers was an admiral who was another of the commodores that had been called back to do convoy duty. And he had done several trips with the captain of the Stirling Castle. So I was asked once or twice up to have a drink with the captain. I was the only one who got a drink on board.
What do you think the POWs thought of you?
Of us? Well, to be quite honest, I never really talked to them very much. They all kept much to themselves. probably they'd been in the same camps and everything else. So the Navy kept much to themselves on board. But where it was difficult, you see, was when we'd gone through the Panama Canal, which was fascinating. I stayed on deck the whole 8 hours. It was fascinating doing that. We arrived in the Pacific, which was a war zone. Now, they were up on deck, smoking. And you would say to them, look, the glow of a cigarette can be seen. If you want a torpedo in your side, you're going the best way about it. But they were so bloody-minded, they didn't seem to care. And it really was, you couldn't give them an order. Who was there to enforce it? The fact that you were an officer would probably inflame them more. So it was a case of trying to persuade them and try to make them see that the danger endangered them as well as yourself. It was really quite a problem, that. Really was. We got to Wellington, where they said you could always tell a man from Wellington because he'd put his head down as he went round a corner. The wind was always so bad. And that was quite an amusing incident because I had a meal in a Wellington hotel, and at the end the waitress asked me for my food coupons. And I looked at her astonished. I said, I'm terribly sorry, I haven't got any. I didn't know I had to. If we had a meal out in England, in spite of rationing, we didn't have to produce them. Well, she said, the thing is that we're sending all our beef and lamb and so on to England, and we're rationed almost more than you. And she was very sweet. She tore coupons out of her own book and made them up for me. So I've never forgotten that waitress, which was very kind.
You had a winning smile.
Well, I don't know. I was really kind of her. So we spent 3 days in Wellington, and then we arrived in Sydney, and I was sent out to what was called a MONAB, which stood for Mobile Naval Air Base. A MONAB was a thing that advanced, obviously on land, with naval aircraft to support the Navy in places like the islands in the Pacific and so on. But this was just a transit camp. And it was out at Parramatta, which I suppose was about 20 miles outside Sydney. And I was there. The atom bomb had been dropped, well, the two atom bombs, and Japan had surrendered. That was VJ night. And the Australians went quite mad. I was in a tram trying to get to Parramatta, and they kept on pulling the conductor rail off the electric wire, so it would go about 20 yards, and then you'd fail to go anywhere. They pulled all the trees off the cenotaph in Sydney. They went absolutely mad, and if you can see Australians drunk, it's an unenviable sight. So, I had been appointed to the fleet aircraft carrier Indomitable, which was, let's face it, a plum job. She hadn't come in when I got out to Sydney, which was why I'd been sent to the MONAB. And then she and the rest of the British Pacific Fleet came in. And, now, excuse me, the war has ended, but we went on up to Hong Kong to take it over. Do you want that?
Yes, please.
I tripped up the gangway found that I was one of the junior fighter directors, of which there were about eight. All, of course, RNVR. I loved my time in Indomitable because here was the real thing that I joined, that I'd trained for at last. And it was a very large wardroom. I suppose there were about 200 officers in it, mostly, of course, pilots. And what interested me was that there was a lift from the wardroom up to the bridge, which I thought was a crazy idea, really. I mean, when I had to keep watch on the bridge, it was all right, but you just have your supper and go up in the lift. But nobody was going to take the lift if the enemy was going to attack or anything like that. And I could never understand why it had been put there, but there we are. It was very useful.
So a huge...
A huge 30,000-ton aircraft carrier, yeah. And she was part of the British Pacific Fleet.
What did you think of the Fleet Air on pilots and so on?
Oh, I liked them enormously, and I thought that they did a wonderful job, because the RAF were good enough. But you have to remember that the naval pilots, apart from the fact that if they didn't find the ship, they would die because they'd go in the drink. Very often, especially, of course, in the Atlantic or somewhere like that, they had to land on a bucking deck, which was no fun at all. What would happen was the... Do you know the thing about the batsman?
Yes. Yeah.
You know about that, yeah. Well, no, I don't need to say it. But they... To land on a bucking deck, it can't be much fun.
A particular breed of men, people often say.
Yes, I suppose so. We had three squadrons on board. One was what was called a TBR squadron, which was torpedo bomber reconnaissance. They were American Grumman aircraft with three cockpits, pilot, observer, and gunner. And then there were two fighter squadrons, which were American Corsairs with gull wings. All American stuff, I'm afraid. But it made it useful from the point of view that the Americans were very much, of course, in being in the Pacific, and you could get spares more easily and so on. I don't think that English manufacturers could keep up with the supply of naval aircraft as much as, you know, the Americans could.
So your first trip was to Hong Kong, wasn't it?
Well, yes, it was. We left Sydney and we went up to Manus, which was in the Admiralty Islands and had been the base of the British Pacific Fleet for some time. It was delightful, sort of Dorothy L'Amour Island, you know what I mean? A real sort of Pacific island. You expected somebody to come out in a sarong and greet you, but unfortunately they didn't. So we stayed there for about two or three days. And then we went on up to Subic Bay, which was the big American base in the Philippines, a little north of Manila. And there it was a bit much, really, because we had to wait there, and I believe this to be true. We didn't know it at the time, of course, but we were waiting permission to, or orders to go into Hong Kong and relieve the colony. But Roosevelt apparently was talking to Stalin as to whether or not we should be allowed to do it. I think that's true. And eventually, you know, the permission was granted, but rather a monstrous thing.
So would I be right in thinking that Roosevelt would rather the Americans had gone in? And
yes, yes. Mm-hmm. They never wanted us in the Pacific at all. And when we went ashore at the American officer's base, they were all one end of the mess, we were at the other end. Nobody attempted to come and see us and make us welcome or anything, which was sad. They'd said all of this stemmed from Admiral Ernest J. King, who was the head of the U.S. Navy during the war, and he'd apparently said, "I served under the goddamn British in the First World War, and I'm damn sure I'm not going to serve under them in the next."
So you sailed into Hong Kong.
Well, yes, but this is quite interesting too, because we eventually got permission to go off to Hong Kong, and we set off quite a task force. I mean, two aircraft carriers, cruisers, and so on, under the command of Admiral Harcourt of Battle of the River Plate fame. Now, quite obviously, there were minefields protecting Hong Kong, laid by the Japanese, and we needed to know what they were. So we flew off an aircraft, which had a pilot and observer on board, and there was a spare cockpit for another occupant. And it was to pick up a Japanese army officer called Nakamura, who was a member of the Kampai Te, which was the Japanese Gestapo. And he was flown on board and landed on board us and showed us the minefields, and then he was flown back again. But the aircraft got into cloud over the South China Sea and had to make a forced landing. And they landed all right, but they were surrounded by Chinese guerrillas. And the guerrillas, one of them who spoke English, said to the pilot of the aircraft, pointing to Nakamura, they said, "Can we behead him?" So the pilot managed to say, "Well, I don't think so." He said, "He's a bit more used to us alive than dead." And so they had a long conversation, and then they turned wistfully to the pilot and said, "Well, could we just shoot him instead?" So then we had all to be inoculated against all the diseases that were meant to, or probably thought to be prevalent in Hong Kong. And I think it was yellow fever, typhus, plague, all of them. And we had such a cocktail of these things that I had what's called post-inoculation fever. I was absolutely out. I couldn't remember anything for about 48 hours. And so I never saw Center Hong Kong at all. But there we were in the end, and we anchored in this lovely bay. It's a beautiful bay. Have you ever been there? Mm-hmm. And of course, there were none of the high skyscrapers that are there now. You can see, I'll show you a photograph of us there, which is behind me. And we weren't allowed ashore, the Navy at first. The Royal Marines went ashore and cleared up the Japanese troops and so on. But a rather nice incident was that our captain, Chas, J.A.S. Eccles, was a rather rare bird. He was a Japanese interpreter. And he sat in on the surrender negotiations. And we had a Japanese general who wouldn't cooperate. So Eccles said, "I know what to do with this bastard." And we took away his braces, and I've got a photograph of him holding up his trousers in front of his troops, which made him lose face splendidly, and he cooperated after that.
What did you think of Hong Kong? Was it like anywhere else you'd been?
Well, it was, really. You see, it was not by any shadow of any means at all the incredible financial base that it became. We went up to the peak, had to walk all the way up, and all the houses had all their wood torn from them because the Chinese had used it for fuel. There were five different currencies going at the same time: British pounds, Australian pounds, Japanese yen, Chinese dollars, and all changing exchange rates almost hourly. So we didn't buy much. But there were some Chinese tailors and so on who had hidden cloth and so on. And I think I was able to buy something, I can't remember what, shirts and so on, which, of course, they're renowned for. But
Did you get a feeling of how the Japanese had treated the local population?
Well, you see, you couldn't converse with them. The ship was surrounded by sampans, all of which hoped that they'd earn a dollar or two. But you couldn't really shout across the side to them much because you're very high up. And so the answer is really no. We never met anybody there who we could, but we did take back about 30 women from, they'd been nurses and this, that and the other, and we brought them back to Sydney.
They were European, were they?
They were European, they were British and so on.
And they'd been interned in Hong Kong.
They'd been interned in Hong Kong, yeah.
What state were they in?
Well, they were very thin, of course. I think they'd been raped. They didn't talk about it very much, and I didn't see them very much. The captain was rather attached to rather a pretty one, and so she was mostly in his quarters. Going back to Sydney, there was an amusing thing where you had to stitch a piece of cloth onto somebody bent over, you know, and so on. And they were adept at doing that. It was a sort of game. It sounds silly at the time, but you didn't have the opportunity to question them. I mean, there were, you know, 1,000 people on board Indomitable, and I forget where these women were accommodated, but you saw them occasionally on deck, and that was about all. So that really is about all. And then we stayed about, we went back to Sydney with the women, and stayed there about a month. And then we set sail for home.
Stop you there.
Yeah.
Adrian Holloway, end of Reel 12.